Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. On today's programme, why are so many young women joining the jihad?
Women join radical groups and travel to Islamic State for both personal and political reasons. I really resist this idea of saying it's all about, you know, emotion, or it's all about finding a husband, or it's all, you know, it's all impulsive or irrational.
Also on Inside Europe, Cyprus keeps a wary eye on developments in Lebanon. A Spanish nurse becomes Europe's first Ebola victim. And ethical banks throw Danish customers a financial lifeline. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. As the battle against Islamic State unfolds, many nations are increasingly worried about casualties closer to home. Hundreds of young Europeans and others have joined the jihadi fight in the Middle East. Experts estimate that up to 10% of them are women, seduced by an idealized version of a true Islamic State. Lisa Bryant takes a look at the phenomenon from France, a leading exporter of female recruits.
RTL Matin. 2 weeks ago, Asia Saidi disappeared from her home in southern France, leaving the reason on her Facebook page, off to join the jihad in Syria. Investigators and her panicked family launched a massive search, and last Saturday, they found the 15-year-old working at a Marseille bar.
J'étais entraînée en voyant les vidéos ça.
Asia told French radio she had been tempted by the jihad through the web, but in Marseille, people told her the recruiters were terrorists. There are plenty of less happy endings. Hundreds of girls and young women are leaving Western nations to join the Islamic State and other radical groups. It's hard to say how many, but France appears to be a leading exporter. Out of nearly 1,000 jihadi recruits from here, more than 60 are female. Today, the spotlight is shifting to this other female face of radical Islam.
This idea of radicalization is very, very popular at the moment, but actually our understanding of it is very limited, because what's become really, really clear is that individual motives are very, very diverse.
That's Catherine Brown, a lecturer in the Defense Studies Department at King College London. She's been analyzing women's role in jihadi movements and scouring social media sites to find out just why Western women are signing up.
Women join radical groups and travel to Islamic State for both personal and political reasons. Because I really resist this idea of saying it's all about, you know, emotion, or it's all about finding a husband, or it's all, you know, it's all impulsive or irrational.
She says some do head out to become so-called jihadi brides, but others are drawn by the vision of a utopian Muslim nation, the one IS is trying to sell, despite its brutal methods.
And then the third thing is a sense of adventurism. It's because they can. International travel is possible now. You can much more easily go abroad. And with the online networks, there is a lot of help and self-help groups enabling them to do that.
French anthropologist Dunia Bouzard heads a new Paris center to prevent radicalization. She says jihadi recruiters use different methods of indoctrinating men and women. Men are captivated by more classical arguments of fighting evil. Recruiters use humanitarian arguments to lure women.
They persuade them they must die in the Holy Land to save those they love. That's the first method of indoctrination. The second is they have to do humanitarian work there. That's why it draws lots of women who want to get into medicine or nursing or social work, altruistic jobs.
But IS is also sending a more activist message, says Islamist expert and former senior counterterrorism official Louis Caprioli.
The Islamic State pushed for a major change. They supported the role of women in the jihad. So it's not just going out to do social work, but actually playing a role. Videos show women using tough language, saying they're going to kill people, and holding a Kalashnikov.
These images have a big impact, Brown says, even if very few women actually head out to battle.
And the reason it's significant is because of our biases. because it's powerful in our society to see women engaging in acts of violence. So it's quite a propaganda coup.
Many recruits come from surprising backgrounds. Some may be Muslims who feel rejected by European society. But 17-year-old Hélène grew up in an atheist household in the Paris suburbs, converting to Islam 2 years ago. France's Le Monde newspaper recounts how she traded her tight jeans for a hijab, watched videos of a Kuwaiti preacher, and had an Egyptian boyfriend who promised to take her to a country that respected Sharia law. In reality, Bouzard says, these young women have only a sketchy notion of the Islamic faith.
Three-quarters of the young women have never set foot in a mosque. On Tuesday, they can eat pork, and on Wednesday, they could be ready to go to Syria. The religious question is never pushed during the indoctrination, only at the end.
Expert Caprioli says young Catholics are also attracted by militant Islam.
They find through Islam a certain rigor that Catholicism doesn't have. They discover Islam is more respectful of women because they live in a Western society where women are aggressed and raped. So they idealize the position of women in Islam, thinking they don't submit to this kind of violence.
The reality, of course, is different. A new United Nations report, for example, describes massive atrocities by Islamic State militants against women in Iraq, including killing and sexual slavery. Researcher Brown says these Western jihadistas get another, less gruesome reality check.
And what we're tending to see again is actually life is quite a lot harsher than they imagined. So there are tweets about, you know, where can I find a hairdryer? The fact that toilets are communal, things like that I don't think they'd particularly thought about before they left.
Once there, some women start campaigning for others to join them, claiming they are living out their dreams. But others, like 16-year-old Noura Elbati from the French city of Avignon, are trapped. In May, her brother Fouad managed to cross into Syria to visit her. He described to local media his unsuccessful efforts to bring her home and how Noura told him that she'd made the mistake of her life. Lisa Bryant, DW, Paris.
As we've reported in previous weeks, Cyprus has become a key component in the coalition against IS. And in an interview with Inside Europe, the country's foreign minister, Ioannis Kasoulidis, has been discussing the reasons why. He's been telling Nathan Morley there are compelling reasons for Cyprus to join the fight.
From his desk in the government district of Nicosia, the Cypriot foreign minister is closely monitoring military operations against ISIS militants. Few had foreseen that the group's push west for territory over the past few months would result in fierce battles so close to the Mediterranean coast. Ioannis Kasoulidis has thrown the full support of Cyprus behind the International Alliance Against ISIS. But as most eyes focus on Syria and Iraq, Kasoulidis is increasingly worried about developments in neighbouring Lebanon. Fighting there between the Lebanese army and ISIS fighters continues, and speaking to Deutsche Welle, he insisted that Lebanon's precarious position could provide an immediate risk for Cyprus if terrorists advance any closer.
Having in mind what has happened in Mosul and in other towns in Iraq to the Christian community, but also to the Yazidis, to other minorities or non-according to them Orthodox Sunnis, we are in danger. And therefore, whether we participate in the coalition or not, we are not exempted from this threat. On the contrary, because of the threat, and in particular our worries lies in Lebanon, we consider that if Lebanon is infiltrated, or Lebanon is at risk, it means that this organization may reach the shores of the Eastern Mediterranean, and immediately after, who comes next? That is our point. Therefore, this organization has to be dealt with and defeated.
Making good on his concerns about the Lebanon, Nicosia will now donate ammunition to the Lebanese army and has also given the green light for the French Air Force to fly sorties from an airbase in Paphos on the west coast of the island. France became the first foreign country to publicly join the United States airstrikes in Iraq, but Mr. Kasalidis says that any military operations from the Cypriot base will be limited in scope.
The French government has asked for our agreement to use the airbase of the National Guard in Paphos, the Andreas Papandreou airbase, for their air force. It will not be the main place of their operations in Iraq, because they concentrate on Iraq, but it may be used for supportive purposes.
So they won't be conducting strikes from Cyprus?
No, it's not their intention. Let me put it this way. They have not asked for this. They have asked for the landings of perhaps carrying aircrafts, not for combat aircrafts, or even the stationing of combat aircrafts on their return from operations if the need arises.
The operations from Paphos will be the first in the fight against the Islamic State launched from the sovereign territory of Cyprus. Meanwhile, 20 miles to the east in Akrotiri, Britain's base there continues to be the staging post for direct offensive action against ISIS in Iraq. Last week, David Cameron paid a lightning visit to Akrotiri, announcing that he was to send a further 2 Tornado planes to supplement the 6 currently operating from there.
I wanted to come and thank the pilots and the ground crews for the absolutely essential, but difficult and dangerous work they're doing over the skies of Iraq, and also coming here today to announce as well that there'll be 2 further Tornadoes coming so we can keep up the tempo of these very important operations, beating back ISIL and helping to save lives in Iraq.
Though they have a record of working closely with each other, frictions between Nicosia and London over the British bases has been frequent over the past decade. The ISIS threat, though, seems to have stilled their differences. And now Kasalidis says that a fluid communication channel between London and Nicosia has been opened.
We have agreed on a policy of no surprises with the British government, which means that we have to be informed and notified about all the intentions of the British government to the use of the bases. So far, from the independence until now, the British bases have not been used as a launching pad for operations in countries of our area. And this was very good for us, because our policy was that our friends, and we are friends with all the countries of our neighborhood, should not ever feel any threat coming from the island of Cyprus. But this time, the issue is totally different. First of all, there is no country of our neighborhood being a threat. On the contrary, the threat is against the countries of our area, our friends and neighbors, and the whole operation against ISIS is to their side and not against them.
Mr. Kasalidis says that one basic unifying interest has brought many countries together in the past few months: their mutual wish to stop the rise of terrorism in the region, and that, he said, is a fight he's willing to be part of. Nathan Morley, Deutsche Welle, Nicosia.
And I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. This week, a Spanish nurse became the first person known to have contracted Ebola here in Europe. It's believed Teresa Romero caught the virus from an infected missionary who'd returned to Spain from Sierra Leone. EU officials say an Ebola epidemic in Europe is still unlikely, but admit the nurse's case has exposed failings in the bloc's health systems. Our Madrid correspondent Guy Hedgeco told me what the Spanish authorities were doing to prevent the virus from spreading.
Several other people are in quarantine, and another 50 or so healthcare workers in Madrid are under observation. There have been a number of other sort of details related to the containment, such as the destroying of the dog belonging to the woman who has been infected, which has been rather sort of controversial. There have been animal rights campaigners campaigning against that, and that sort of raised the temperature of the whole issue. But the authorities at the moment say that it is contained and that they're doing everything possible to keep it that way.
Even so, has the government stepped up screenings for Ebola, for example, at airports?
Well, we haven't so far heard of any measures being taken by the government like that, which some people are surprised at. But this is sort of in line with the government's insistence that it's an isolated case. We seem to know more or less how it was contracted by this woman from one of these missionaries who she was involved in treating in a hospital in Madrid, and a missionary who died at the end of September from Ebola. And the latest information we have on that is that the woman apparently said that she thinks she touched her face with a glove that had been in contact with the man who's infected. So the authorities, you know, think they can pinpoint the reason for the infection. Therefore, they haven't so far taken any measures such as screening people coming into the country and so on. Now, that may happen further down the line if the disease spreads, but so far we haven't seen measures like that.
A lot of immigrants arrive in Spain illegally from Africa. Is that a source of concern?
Well, we haven't heard a lot about this. I mean, the arrival of immigrants from Africa illegally has been an issue for this government and other governments previously for quite some time. It's been a big issue in the news. A lot of immigrants arrive, many of them just by plane, and then they're sent back to their countries. A lot of them arrive by boat. And many also arrive by scaling the fence in North Africa that separates Morocco from the Spanish territories of Ceuta and Melilla. Now, for example, those immigrants who scale the fence, those that do manage to arrive often do so, you know, in quite a bad state physically. For example, lots of cuts and bruises on their bodies. So that, you would think, would be of concern for the authorities. But again, the authorities haven't spoken specifically about that as an issue that they're concerned about at the moment. At least at the moment, it hasn't come to that yet.
So how have Spaniards in general reacted to the news that a local woman has contracted Ebola on Spanish soil? I mean, is there a sense of panic?
I mean, I think it's fair to say there's not a sort of widespread panic. People are worried. Something that has come across from a lot of people I've spoken to is a sort of sense of anger and confusion because they feel they don't have enough information from the authorities. There's a lot of anger directed at the government, particularly at Health Minister Ana Mato. There's been a lot of calls for her resignation over the last few days, people saying that she has just failed to not only to handle the crisis properly, but to communicate with Spanish people and explain to them what's going on. So there's the concern that there's disinformation, there's a lot of rumour going around. And even healthcare workers have been critical of the government on this count, saying that many healthcare workers have not been trained properly to tackle this disease, which it's new for Spain, it's new for most countries in the world. And that Spain, even though it has a very developed healthcare system, it's not completely ready to contain this disease.
And that was our Spain correspondent, Guy Hedgeco.
For more information, go to our webpage, dw.de.
Big Scandinavian banks are dumping tens of thousands of ordinary customers because they don't make them any money. Customers who have been with the banks for years suddenly find themselves out on a limb. But they're being offered lifelines by smaller, so-called ethical banks, which don't have such a hardline attitude towards making money. As Malcolm Brabant reports from Copenhagen, ethical banks are enjoying growing popularity across Europe.
As befits the 50-year-old daughter of a trapeze artist, Tatiana Steen is effortlessly jumping into the air on a unicycle. And then she starts herring around in fast little circles on the wooden floor of the practice room with a high roof from which hangs a trapeze. This is the base of Circus Panic, a circus school for children and the name of her own performing troupe. In order to get her business started, Tatiana needed a loan of $340,000. But, as she explained, her brainchild was almost smothered at birth.
We went to a big bank, but they don't believe in us. They laugh at us, and I cry a little. So angry. I went to the bank, and I come in, and I scream out. Okay, ready, set, go!
A couple of dozen excited children, aged 10 and under, are now leaping over weighted ropes, building up the flexibility and strength required to perform circus tricks. The palpable happiness in this arena only became a reality because of the faith of an ethical bank.
One of my friends told us about another bank. And then we go to this bank and then say, oh, it's fantastic. What is your wish? You know, in other words, and I feel so happy.
More and more Danish customers have found themselves discarded by the country's major financial institutions, especially those who are fiscally prudent and don't have loans. Danske Bank, which holds the accounts of 40% of the nation, recently jettisoned 110,000 customers. Analyst John Norden of mybanker.dk says the main players have been ruthless.
The big bank is dumping the client because of cost. Therefore, some of the client is actually not profitable for them. And therefore, they say, OK, you need to pay some fees to maintain client. And then it actually enables small banks to come with a better offer.
A significant number of disillusioned and rejected customers have turned to so-called ethical banks like Merkur, whose chief executive is Lars Persson.
What we do is to combine what we call classical banking with a vision of a sustainable society. So with classical banking, we mean deposit and loan, so very simple things, no speculation, no fancy financial products. And then we combine leading the money in the direction of sustainability, financing companies that works with sustainability and also social responsibility and even cultural institutions.
But if so many of its clients are relatively impoverished, how can the bank flourish?
We don't want to earn a 20% return on our equity because that is not what our owners go for. But a decent profit, say 5 to 7, 8% of the equity, that is absolutely possible to do with this kind of banking.
At the moment, Merkur has a relatively small client base, but bank analyst John Norden believes it has got growth potential.
The potential is maybe 5% of the market.
For Circus Panic's Tatiana Steen, there's a sense of satisfaction that her bank doesn't pursue the speculative practices of the wolves of Wall Street.
It's rather important that I give no money to war. So I'm so proud when I take my little card. Hello, it's my bank, and it doesn't afford war and other stupid things.
As for Tatiana's business, she's thriving. She employs 6 people, her troupe is performing at top venues, and for someone with the circus running through her DNA, she's fulfilling her dream. No thanks to those big bankers. Malcolm Brabham, DW, Copenhagen.
If you have a comment or query about something you've heard on the program, then do get in touch with us. Our email address is europe@dw.de. I'll just repeat that. The email address is europe@dw.de. Or you can write to us at Inside Europe, Deutsche Welle, Bonn, Germany. Looking forward to hearing from you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. Coming up over the next half hour, we look at how Europe's religious landscape is changing.
I would say that the topic of religion in Austria is actually raising a lot of questions and a lot of debates, not always in the right way as we see. I mean, it's very hard to open a newspaper in Austria and not see something about the topic of religion, be it mostly about the place of Islam in the Austrian society.
Meanwhile, frank talk in the Vatican about what church members really want. How floodwaters have created a new landmine risk in Bosnia. And Europe's Roma call for better opportunities. Stay tuned for those stories and more. Catholic bishops and cardinals from around the world are meeting in the Vatican for closed-door discussions about the role of the family within their church. About 250 mainly male church leaders are exchanging ideas about how the Catholic Church should deal with everything from divorced and remarried members to sex, birth control and gay unions. As Megan Williams reports from Rome, what's clear from the first days of the two-week encounter is that church leaders seem to be realising just how out of touch they've been with what the vast majority of church members want.
Invito tutti a sostenere I lavori del sinodo con la preghiera.
When Pope Francis launched the two-week Vatican Conference on the Family, or the Extraordinary Synod, as the Catholic Church calls it, he gave a clear message to the 250 or so church leaders attending.
Ci associamo spiritualmente.
Francis told those present to listen to each other with humility and to not shy away from speaking their mind out of fear they might offend him or get too close to taboo subjects. If the first days of the conference are anything to go by, it may be one of the more frank conversations church leaders have had in years, with the bishops apparently surprised to learn a thing or two about married life.
The Australian couple were quite explicit and developed in their thoughts and in their emphasis on the central role of sexuality and sexual intercourse in marriage.
That's English Cardinal Bishop Nichols describing the reaction of the bishops after hearing from one married couple invited to speak at the conference. They told church leaders that, stop the press, sex matters to most couples.
Now, that's not what we bishops talk about mostly, to be quite honest. But to hear that as the opening contribution, it was a recognition of that is central to the well-being of a marriage often.
Also discussed by the bishops was what some of them called harsh and exclusive language, long used to describe unmarried couples living together, gay, lesbian, and transgendered people, and the majority of Catholics who use birth control. Vatican spokesperson Father Thomas Rozica pinpointed some terms one of the participants thought it might be time to change.
Language such as living in sin, intrinsically disordered, or contraceptive mentality are not necessarily words that invite people to draw closer to Christ and the Church.
And drawing people closer to the Church is mainly what this synod is about. The idea itself came last year from Pope Francis, who, since becoming leader of the world's Catholics over a year ago, has stressed compassion, empathy, and acceptance over finger-waving at those who don't abide by Catholic rules. Observers say, with this meeting on the family, he may be trying to infuse his own simple, down-to-earth style into the broader Church. Many observers have credited Francis's listening style with drawing people closer to the Catholic Church. But critics of the conference say while listening is good, you also need to include a full range of views to find out what people really feel, something they say is missing from a synod on the family composed primarily of celibate men. The Australian couple who talked about the importance of sex, well, they are one of only 12 married couples allowed to attend the conference. One of the other couples here from the U.S. lead a group that promotes natural family planning.
Catholics oppose the Church's teaching on natural family planning. They do not believe that that is the only way that Catholics should be allowed to make decisions about their own family size, when to have them, spacing, and all those things.
Deborah Rose Milovec is a member of the global Catholic movement calling for reform called We Are Church. She says the church's own surveys show the vast majority of its followers are in favor of birth control, and studies show they use it and have abortions at the same rate as everybody else, despite conservative Catholic leaders' efforts to stop it.
We know that Catholics are doing it at the same levels as everybody else in society, so it's not as if somehow the formation of these ideas within the walls of the hierarchy have actually accomplished anything that the hierarchy wanted out of this. I mean, Catholics are not paying attention to this. They are going on their own.
Rose Milovec says she doesn't see change in doctrine coming out of this synod, which has its final round of talks next October. But what she says will almost surely come out of it is less enforcement of the rules. For Miriam Dugnan, who's been lobbying to allow women to become priests, that's good news in itself. Dugnan traveled to Rome this week to voice her desire for change within the church from outside the synod.
If all Francis manages to do is encourage bishops to speak out and to say what they really think, then he will start a revolution almost by accident. And it won't happen immediately, but if one change comes out of this synod, whether it starts with priestly celibacy or attitudes to homosexuality or birth control, it will be the first crack in the wall. And it will be like the Berlin Wall. It will be an unstoppable train.
Or so many Catholics who have long felt excluded or alienated from their church are now hoping. Megan Williams, DW Radio, Rome.
Well, the Austrian capital, Vienna, was once a place we would describe as mainly Catholic or even overwhelmingly Catholic. But not anymore. New studies show a city with a rapidly changing religious and ethnic structure, with almost a third of its population foreign-born and Catholicism on the wane. Kerry Skyring reports on Vienna's rapidly changing religious landscape and how the city is dealing with it.
The bells of St. Stephen's. The sound is synonymous with the city, just like the cathedral in which the bells hang. It's a big draw for the tourists who flock here for the tour of its catacombs and to climb its towers. But for the citizens of the Austrian capital, this church and the hundreds of others which dominate its landscape is increasingly irrelevant. Still a draw for the tourists, but no longer a big draw for the majority, because in Vienna, Catholics are rapidly becoming the minority.
So, but okay, if we start with the global flow of people, that's a new way of visualizing it.
Ramon Bauer, crunching the numbers at the Vienna Institute of Demography. With a mouse click, he can illustrate the world's changing religious and demographic landscape. And Ramon's own city, Vienna, is a striking example of this revolution in religion, brought about by migration, changing fertility, and religious beliefs. In 1970, more than 80% of Viennese said they were Catholic. Now fewer than half say that.
It's mainly, I would say, social change towards a postmodern society on the one hand, driving them out of the churches. We see also in the statistics that every scandal in the Catholic Church was related to a lot of exits from the church. So with every scandal, more and more were leaving the church.
That's part of the picture. But since the 1970s, there have been waves of immigration from Turkey and Northern Africa, and in the past decade also from the east and southeast of Europe. Anne Goujon is leader of the Human Capital Data Lab at the Wittgenstein Center in Vienna. She's looking at the past, present, and future of Vienna's religious landscape and finding some tension associated with these changes.
I would say that the topic of religion in Austria is actually raising a lot of questions and a lot of debates, not always in the right way as we see. I mean, it's very hard to open a newspaper in Austria and not see something about the topic of religion, be it mostly about the place of Islam in the Austrian society. And so I think what we see in Vienna and in Austria is not very different from what we see across all European countries.
Another big
driver of change in the religious landscape is the rapid increase in the number of people with no religious affiliation.
Within Europe, we have clearly a trend towards more secularization. This is led mostly by people having more individual sense of religion, so not adhering to a religious denomination as such, but having a belief in themselves. And therefore, we have an increased trend towards secularization.
No sign of secularization here. This is a special prayer service at a mosque on the banks of the Danube River in Vienna. The faithful are being called to show their opposition to radical Islam and the Islamic State fighters in Iraq and Syria. Hundreds pour into the compound, spilling out of the mosque into marquees and meadows. It's in stark contrast to the scene in many of the city's churches, where empty pews are the norm.
Once, as I came to Austria in 1986, we were accused that time. We are hiding ourselves in the cellar and under the ground. What are they doing there?
Tarafa Bagajati is the chairman of the Austrian Muslim Initiative. The mosque in which we meet is the only one in Vienna with a minaret. A prominent sign proclaims its height as a rather modest 32 metres. The city doesn't ban minarets, but it rarely approves them, even though Islam will be the religion of 19% of the population by 2031. Mr. Bagajati says it's time for Muslims and their mosques to be more visible.
As an example, we have now a very beautiful Islamic cemetery in Vienna. It needed more than 30 years of negotiation till we have it. And now everybody is happy. The neighbors are happy. The people are happy. That means we should give the knowledge of the people that our visibility is not against the society. Our visibility is a part of this society.
Just a few hundred metres from St. Stephen's Cathedral, another set of bells rings out from the belfry of the 600-year-old Church of the Maltese Order. It's midday on one of the city's exclusive shopping streets. The bell reminds believers that it's time to stop worshipping Mammon and come to prayer. Despite the noisy reminder, only two people turn up. Inside the church, I'm meeting Eitan Reif, spokesman for an organization called Religion is a Private Matter, which campaigns for separation of church and state and an end to religious discrimination. With demographers forecasting that the number of people with no religious affiliation will soon be in the majority, Eitan Reif says it's time to change some laws.
Actually, privilege one group means the discrimination of another group. This is the wrong way. The better way to do it is just to try and define laws that will apply to everyone and maybe remove some of the, older laws that are pretty much obsolete by now.
Vienna's Catholic Christian traditions are visible and audible just about wherever you go in the city. But changing demographics mean others are beginning to demand their place in this religious landscape. Kerry Skyring, DW, Vienna.
The Balkans are still recovering from devastating floods back in May that destroyed houses, infrastructure, and left tens of thousands of people homeless. But in northern Bosnia, there's another concern. Landmines dating back to the war of the early 1990s were displaced by the floodwaters. And 5 months on, it's difficult to know where they've landed up. Mitra Nazar has more.
The village of Vucilovac was completely flooded back in May. Since then, the water may have receded, but the villagers now have to worry about a deadlier problem.
The village has spots of mine suspect areas. The suspect area is on that side and that side, and it's really, it's all over. They live in the middle of minefield, let's say. And now it is even more dangerous because there is a possibility that new mines have been brought here.
Svetlana Pavlovic is the director of a small NGO called Posavina Bezmina. Her organization identifies and marks mined areas, carries out demining and provides mine risk education. Svetlana says that during the war, Vucilovac was surrounded by minefields laid by all sides of the conflict.
That's a Serbian village. At the beginning of war, they left the village, and it was first it was taken by Croats, and then Serbs returned. So armies were moving back and forward, and they put like many layers of mines in the entire village.
This year's floods swept over those mines, possibly moving them into the village, agricultural fields, backyards. Nobody knows. But since then, the authorities have made little attempt to inspect and secure the area.
Everything is difficult. The mining became really difficult. You see like forest, bushes, high vegetations. It's hard to access with machines. And the state does not have money. Donors from outside, I mean, they are still involved, but less and less. It's been almost 19 years since the war was over.
In the town of Tuzla, Amir Mujanović agrees that the floods have increased the danger posed by landmines. He's the director of the Landmine Survivors Initiative. The war, he says, is still killing people.
There are over, or at least, 8,322 mine survivors and mine victims in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Just in January, we had three separate incidents within the period of 2 weeks in which six persons were actually involved, including three persons were killed.
One of the incidents in January involved 18-year-old Mirnis Niksic. We sit down in his family's house and he tells me what happened.
It was January the 14th. I went to the woods with my friend to collect firewood. We know we have to be careful. We've lived around minefields all our lives. There were no warning signs. My friend lifted a piece of wood and there was an explosion. I lost consciousness. When I woke up, my arm was covered in blood and my friend was on the ground crying, "Dear mother, I'm going to die." He died before the ambulance came.
The accident has changed his life. Mirnis is now 30% disabled and he doesn't even trust landmine warning signs anymore. Never again, Mirnis says, will he walk on something that is not asphalt or concrete. A few hundred landmines have been located outside the marked areas since the floods. But around 50,000 other pieces of unexploded ordnance have also been discovered. Stuff that has been kept in basements or buried in gardens after the war simply floated away. Svetlana Pavlovic again.
Shell, ammunition, bullets, mortar shell, a tank shell, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Anything can be found
here. So it's
here.
Mines and...
yeah, all those dangerous things that then when you touch them, they can explode. Yeah. They all have still fuses, and fuses live forever, you know. They cannot be destroyed by bad weather, by rain, by water, by anything.
So also not by a flood?
No.
The Bosnian Mine Action Center, the army and some NGOs have been doing emergency work since the floods, but that work has only just started. Bosnia has been trying to rid itself of landmines for nearly 20 years, but the work is expensive, the process is slow, and bureaucracy and corruption don't help. There are still 1,200 square kilometers suspected of containing mines. Amir Mujanović from the Landmine Survivors Initiative says that over the years, the Bosnian government hasn't invested enough money in mine clearance. And that, he says, means people are risking their lives in order to survive.
You know, mine-affected communities cannot develop because they prevent access to infrastructure objects. People cannot access their land and cultivate it. So in such instances, people even take a risk entering the mine's hazardous area and risking their life in order to generate income.
And the warning signs that should prevent people from entering these minefields get stolen too.
Every year they were supposed to check if the mark signs are in the place or replace them if they were, you know, were removed or stolen. However, I haven't heard for any case in which the police put criminal charges against those who removed them or prosecuted those. I know it's difficult to, you know, to identify the person, but I'm not sure that is impossible.
After a long day in the field, Svetlana from the NGO Posavina Bezmina is disappointed by what she's seen. So little has been done to secure the people who live in the flooded and mined areas. But then, if Bosnia had worked more effectively to get rid of these minefields over the past 20 years, this extra danger created by the floods wouldn't have happened.
It has to do with the extremely high corruption in this country. That's a problem that is killing us. Everybody knows that. It's not only the mining, it's not only this job, it's entire country. And I think that a lot of money was just vanished.
Bosnia wanted to have demining completed by 2019. Even before the floods, that target was looking pretty unlikely. Now the floods have made the work even slower. Over the next few months, the authorities, the army and NGOs will try to determine where exactly the mines have shifted to. In the meantime, around 500,000 Bosnians will have to be very careful, knowing that they live near mine-contaminated areas, because it could be a matter of life and death. Mitra Nazar for DW, Bosnia and Herzegovina.
And I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. The Roma, or Romani people, are one of the most socially and economically disadvantaged ethnic minorities in Europe. And that's apparent in the education systems of EU countries. Research reveals that Roma children face discrimination in gaining access to even the most basic schooling. Well, in a landmark decision, the EU's executive, the European Commission, has announced it's moving to take the Czech Republic to court on this issue. The Commission has accused Prague of breaching EU law by allowing Roma children to be segregated into separate schools. The move has been welcomed by activists representing the estimated 6 million Roma living in EU countries, but it's also sparked a discussion on Roma integration. From Brussels, James Paniki reports.
It was October 1992. Programs had already started in the whole of Romania. But when I heard voices and beatings in the door, I thought that me and my family were going to get killed. I was only 14. My name is Isabella. I am Romanian and I am Romani woman.
This video by Amnesty International is designed to highlight just how recent the persecution of Roma has been in a number of Eastern EU countries. The legacy of that violence is a shocking level of social disadvantage, with Roma communities facing health and educational challenges unthinkable in mainstream European society. Many Roma attribute that disadvantage directly to the entrenched discrimination which their communities continue to face throughout the European Union. Soraya Post is a Swedish member of the European Parliament and was the keynote speaker at a recent Roma conference in Brussels.
Thank you. The Bachtalis al Rom, Naisle Devlis, Garaklama Mekate, Naimange Bravo, Tevorbi Amarishib, Hagadedav, English Iskuship. I just greeted the Roma people and non Roma people in my language, which is Romanishib, and for me it's very important to speak in my language when I have the opportunity in these big conferences.
Soraya Post describes herself as a member of Sweden's Sinti community, which has had a presence in the country since the 1500s. For her, the issue of state discrimination affecting all areas of Roma life is very personal. She says her mother was forced to have an abortion when pregnant with her third child as a result of what was then the Swedish government's policy.
It was because of her ethnicity. And because in Sweden at the time, since 20, there was a race biological plan for which people, some people were not welcome. When I was going to enter the first class in school, I had to go through a psychologic test because the school didn't want me to be in the school. I have bad experience, but I have a lot of experience of being a Roma in Sweden.
The issue of education is an important one for many members of the Roma or Romani communities of the EU. Roma children are 27 times more likely to be placed in schools for mentally disabled students than their non-Roma counterparts, which is why the Commission's decision to challenge the Czech Republic school system is so important. Violeta Najdanova is a Roma policy analyst with the Open Society European Policy Institute, an NGO. She's a Bulgarian of Roma origin and has been campaigning to get the Commission to come out strongly on the issue of Roma education.
14 years, Roma kids, parents, us, a lot of people in Czech Republic are waiting for justice for this case. I don't know if you know a little bit of a history, but the case was brought to the European Court of Human Rights in 2000 already. And in 2007, there was already judgment coming from the same court that there is a racial discrimination in education for these Roma kids.
But why did it take the Commission so long, given that this has been bubbling away for 8 years now, as you point out?
You see, I don't think the problem was in evidence, because we brought enough evidence to the Commission, plus we have evidence from the court. We brought several briefings from parents. We brought data. What we think the problem was is political, that the Commission couldn't decide that they can take someone, a member state, to court because of a Roma discrimination.
Najdanova now hopes the Commission will consider legal action in EU member states, where she says the education system is equally discriminatory: France, Italy, Slovakia, Hungary and Greece. However, the broader issue of the role the EU can play in bringing about greater levels of integration of Roma communities is complex and politically charged. The European Union has a number of programs in place to assist local governments in their efforts, and mayors from across Europe have gathered at this conference to compare notes. Yet the accusation that national government policies in Eastern Europe may be pushing Roma communities westward was never far from the surface. Daniel Termont, the mayor of the Belgian city of Ghent, took issue with a local government representative from Bulgaria.
I'm convinced that you're working very hard, but then I'm wondering why are 10,000 and 10,000 Roma leaving your country? If you work very hard and you have results with the money of Europe, then they can stay where they are. Because they need a search to move. Eh? Those people want to have their own life, want to have their own culture and want to stay where they are if they have a happy life.
MEP Soraya Post agrees and says the EU needs to tackle what she calls anti-gypsy prejudice head on. Until it does, little will change for the EU's estimated 6 million Roma people.
It has to be a shame to act and to speak anti-Gypsies towards Roma.
My mother was the first from her village who got to university. Today, there are 42 members of my family who got university degrees. My name is Katalin, I'm Hungarian, and I'm a Roma woman.
From Brussels, this is James Paniki reporting for DW.
And that's all we've time for on the show. I hope you enjoyed it. It was produced with help from Sarah Steffen and sound engineer Claudia Rack. I'm Helen Sini. Thanks for joining me. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.